Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My guest today is a game developer and founder of Vizai Games. At the age of 12, he moved to Canada from southern India, then, hoping to enter the games industry, studied computer science at the University of Toronto. After graduating, my guest took a programming job at a mobile game studio. In his spare time, he and an artist friend started working on a project of their own, a narrative cooking game about an Indian mother who comes to Canada with her family in the 1980s. In the game, players cook various dishes and restore lost recipes, exploring the role that food can play in enabling immigrants' families to connect to their heritage. Venba launched in 2023 to widespread acclaim. The LA Times described it as alternately heartbreaking and heartwarming. Welcome, Abhi.
Hi, hi Simon. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for doing this. It's nice to meet you. I really, really enjoyed your game, so thank you for making it.
Thank you. I'm really glad to hear that.
So, let's talk about food for a second. What's the meal or recipe that has helped you most connect to your early childhood before you left India?
Yeah, so this keeps changing for me, which I think is funny. Specifically, I think one thing I always like is in South Indian restaurants, they offer something called full meals, which is not one dish, but a multiple dishes, like a full course, like three course meal. But it's all served over like a banana leaf, and it's like rice and a bunch of different meat and vegetable sides. And that's home cooking in general, right? Like that's kind of a feast. It's very similar to what Venba makes in a level. And if I'm missing home, I think that is my go-to dish. Yeah,
it sounds delicious. Was your who was the cook in your family?
Well, growing up, my mom was definitely the best cook, and she still is the best cook. But I've picked up quite a few recipes and learnings from her. But when it comes to cooking South Indian food, there's no competition. Among my friends, I'm pretty good. But if I'm home, then it's my mom's food that takes the cup. But I found like little inroads, when it comes to like healthy eating and like salads or things like that, or if it's pasta night or something like that, that my mom also enjoys, those are the times for me to shine. So I've made my peace that way, but yeah.
That's nice. And obviously in Venbo, it's a cooking game and you piece together these Indian recipes from sets of ingredients. I'm guessing you made these dishes while you were researching and writing the game. Did you make all of them, and which one came out best?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, I think like just because of the process, we just had to.
No.
And initially the idea was that we would cook together with the whole team, but the game started and then the pandemic hit. So it was a lot of cooking at home and then documenting and sending photos and stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
But I think what came out best, I would say I'm really happy with my biryani. It's become like a go-to. It's something I wouldn't attempt because it's so intimidating. For Venba, I had to. and it's become like a go-to thing.
Oh, nice.
It's interesting because biryani is something you make when there's a lot of people around, when it's festive. But for Venba, I had to like make biryani and then eat it for 3 days straight. And it like broke the norm of like it becoming acceptable for solo cooking, you know, because it was...
Yeah, biryani is really popular over here.
Yeah.
In the UK.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, the game, as I said in the intro, tells the story of an immigrant family. And it's, you know, really interesting because you explore that tension between the eagerness to assimilate in a new culture, but also... I guess that what comes along with that is the guilt at how assimilation, you know, sort of alienates a person from their original culture in some way. It makes them a bit different.
Yeah.
That's a mature theme that feels quite rooted in a lifelong experience. But, you know, you're a person in your 20s, I think. So, you know, where were you drawing all that material from as a relatively young person?
Yeah. So I think for me, there's an assumption that Venba's story is autobiographical. I'm Kevin, or like I'm, you know, and the story is like Venba is my mom, etc. And when the game came out, like family friends of my parents were all like calling to say, hey, you know, your son made a game about you, how do you feel, you know? but it's really not, because I think the relationship I have with my parents is very different, and I'm a person who can go back home and fit in, like go back to India and fit in quite well. I can speak Tamil really well, and it's very different. And I think it's at the age, you know, that I came here, it makes a difference, right? Because some of my friends here, they were born here, they grew up here, so they never had that perspective, you know? Venba is really inspired from those families and the kind of tensions that I see there. And what was interesting to me was that the kind of people who got to tell these stories were children who grew up here and, you know, became, you know, storytellers, et cetera, right? But I always felt like in that perspective, the story of the parents of like why they chose to move here and why do they, you know, insist on holding on to their roots and why is it so important for them? Like, I feel like that gets lost a bit. And even in these immigrant stories, right? So Venba is about like retelling that same immigrant story, but from the perspective of the parents. Because often when meeting these families here, I feel like, you know, the things they've done to even move here is so dramatic. So, and like they would just drop that like a lower bomb on you, like very casually, like, yeah, I had to do this to get here. And I feel like, oh, man, these people are not like, from our view, they're just parents, but like they're completely their own people, right? And they've had such rich and full lives. So why is it that it bothers them so much, right? And that's what I wanted to explore with Venba.
Did you interview any of your sort of parents, friends or anything like that?
Yeah, I think it was really a lifelong process. Like many moments are taken from many things I've witnessed across my life. Like one strong example is when I would go to my friends' places, they would be really happy to see me because they can speak to me in Tamil, but the parents of the friends, I mean, but they can't speak to their own children.
Oh, I see.
In Tamil. Right. And
how did your friends react to that?
Yes.
Were they kind of annoyed at you?
Yeah, exactly. They were like, what the hell? You're like the model kid, right? But similarly, I was also excited to talk to them in Tamil, right? And I think what would happen is there's even some points where like I had to act as a translator for the child and the parent. And like that was, even at that age, it was very shocking for me.
That's intense.
You're right. And there's a certain loneliness, you know, that comes with their lives of like not being able to connect with the people that's closest to them. And I think that bothered me enough to like start making a game about that years later in Venba. It was not a sit down interview process. It's just various things I've observed.
Yeah, you just picked it all up. So wait, Guy, I mean, going back to that thing where you were saying you were having to almost interpret for your friend's parents to their children, your friends.
Yeah.
What kind of thing? So is this because the parents could express themselves sort of more fluently in Tamil, but they couldn't do so in English. So what kind of thing were you having to translate?
Yeah. So it's really interesting because the way it would work is that, and I think this is something specific for South Asian parents, because even growing up, they all have like a level of command in English, because of, you know, British colonialization. Like, they're all familiar with the language, right? But they're not comfortable enough to speak it, but they're comfortable enough to understand it.
Right.
But where they get trouble is when in phrases or like, you know, slang and especially accents. Like, if the accent is, if you're speaking in a, you know, perfect North American English accent, then they have a harder time understanding than like a very heavy Indian accent, right? So, and that's what their kids speak in. So what would happen is that the kids would speak in English, the parents would speak in, and it's the opposite for the kids, right? They would understand Tamil, but they would not be able to speak it super well. So if I wasn't there, the mom would say something in Tamil and the kid would say something in English. It's hampered, but it would get by. But when I'm there, it's like new areas of conversation opens up.
Right.
So it's things like, for example, we would be talking about, let's say, food. And, you know, if she would cook something, and then if I said something about the food, she would be talking about a vegetable. And then she'd be like, what do you say for that in English? And then I'll be like, oh, it's called this. And then you'd be like, oh, that's what she's talking about. You know, like those kind of interactions. Yeah.
Right.
And I think the painful thing is, and I've seen this now, that some of my friends are older, and they have kids who, you know, start going to school, right? So when they're born, the first 3 years, they speak perfect Tamil at home, right? That's when they pick it up. But the moment they go to school, that's when they start leaving the Tamil back. And they, to the point where they start speaking in English at home. And I think it's interesting here, like the parents are kind of conflicted on this. Like some parents feel like this is good. It's good that my son or my daughter is speaking English because this is going to give them an edge.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they encourage it. And then other parents are like, no, you know, they have to speak in Tamil. And it becomes like a challenge, right? They refuse to speak in Tamil at home. I don't know why that is, right? And it's very interesting, but I've seen that shift happen every time a kid goes to school. So I think it's like, yeah, it starts very young, but yeah, all of these things is what I think I wanted to touch upon in Venba.
Yeah, right. Just going back as well to something you said earlier, you mentioned that when the game came out, you had people were phoning up your mum and saying, oh, I've played a B's game about you. How did she react to that?
Yeah. So my mom and dad both had a very interesting relationship with video games. So my mom, they were both against it, and definitely like me getting into it as a career was something that was disappointing to them in the early days. But after I just doubled down on it, I think they've come around. And with Venba, it was interesting because I didn't even tell them that I was making this game. They found out about it because an Indian newspaper wrote about it in India.
Really?
Yeah. And my uncle read the paper and he was like, game developer Toronto Abhi. And he's like, I know who that is.
I know that kid.
So he calls my dad and he's like, oh, is your son, you know, making a video game? I read about it in the paper. And my dad's like,
oh my gosh, he exposed you, your own uncle.
Yeah. And that's how they knew about it. And they were kind of a little hurt, actually. And I think, you know, in some ways, then I am very much like Coven from the game. But I think that distance was just that it's not that I tried to hide it from them or anything like that. It's just more, it was hard for them to understand.
Yeah, sure. Have they played it?
Yes, very recently, actually. Very, very recently. I think a month ago, my dad called me up and said they're both in India right now. They're visiting. And he got a kid from there to like set it up on his laptop, which is great. I really appreciate that. And I think what's been interesting is that even there's a lot of people, like younger family friends and people who understand Venba as a video game and understand that it's having a real impact. But my parents, video game was too new as a medium for them to quite wrap their head around.
Sure.
And they're like, and my mom, I remember she was like, why would somebody play a game like this? Like, it was a genuine question. Like, it's about a kitchen. It's not interesting. Like, usually aren't games about, like, you know, wars and things like that. And I said, yeah, you know, that's true. I hope that's not too true, you know. What really helped is when Venba launched, there's a bunch of Tamar YouTubers from Tamil Nadu who picked it up. And even on day one, they were like ready for it. They streamed it and they would like translate the dialogues in Tamar as they played it, right?
Oh, wow.
For their Tamar audiences. And those streams, ironically, those helped my mom and dad understand. Okay, because they're seeing how people react to it. They're seeing like line by line how it. So that really helped them understand like, okay, so it's very much like movies. You can tell stories in this platform too, right? So
incredible. Well, we'll come back to all of that a bit later. But for now, let's come to the premise of the podcast. So,
yes,
Abhi, I've asked you to pick the 5 video games you'd like to put on your very own fictional games machine. I'm really excited to chat to you about these 5. So, why don't you start off by telling us about your first game, which is from 1988.
I believe that one is Dangerous Dave. So this was a really interesting challenge for me. And I want to, like, I thought really hard about how to approach this question. But ultimately, I just decided, like, various touchstones in my game, in my life would be interesting. And this game is called Dangerous. It's an MS-DOS game. And to my surprise, a lot of my friends here haven't heard about this game. But growing up in India, it is the game.
I hadn't heard of it, actually, but it was designed by John Romero, right, who made Doom.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing is that, okay, so in India, gaming started off in a very interesting way, which is that it started on the backs of piracy, right? So really, a lot of people got exposed to gaming in the 90s, 94, which is when I was born, and it was on this bootleg Terminator
was the name of the console.
Yes, Terminator was the name of the console, and it was a bootleg NES. Nice. Essentially, like what happened is that like India was always like 10 or 20 years behind what the Western world was playing. So when, you know, people were playing Nintendo 64 games, we were playing like 2D. Oh, you can have platform. Oh, this is very new. Right. And I'm really grateful for that experience because I think it gave me like a full history of the video games. I was able to grow up from as if I was born in the 80s. And Dangerous Dave was that one game that was on every computer. I don't know how it got there, but it was a DOS game. It's great. And it has what people would now call really annoying sound effects and platforming and everything, but it was just beautiful. It's a game that I would play again and again. It was my first introduction to platforming, upgrades. There's a point where you pick up a gun and it's very interesting. A jetpack, and it's still a very hard game to beat and very charming. It's the kind of game that you'd go to your friend's place and they'd be like, oh, I got stuck at this part. But you would have to start from all the way from beginning, right? So, but I'll be like, no, you know what? I know exactly how to get past that.
Always forward for you.
Yes.
See, I mean, you mentioned before that your parents were quite skeptical about video games. Did they buy you this Terminator bootleg console?
That's a really good question. That's actually why they were skeptical. So the problem was, so this bootleg console they got, and I actually wanted to cheat your question a bit because there's a cartridge called 999 games in one. And I thought I could select that.
It's not quite in the spirit of the...
quite in the spirit. That had a collection of, like, you know, Super Mario Brothers, you know, Duck Hunt. And the problem actually wasn't me. The problem was that my mom really got into Super Mario Brothers, the first one, the NES game. Right. And she got to the point in World 8-8, there's like a maze. Like, you can't just beat it, right? You have to go in a specific order. Otherwise, the level will keep looping. She couldn't figure out how to beat it. So she took 2 days off work. And she still couldn't figure it out. And then the conclusion she came to was like, video games are too addictive and poisonous, and they will
She's anti-video games because of her own failings at Super Mario Brothers.
Really, yes. Yeah, so Miyamoto is to blame for all of this. But yeah, she's like, no, it's too addictive. It made me take days off work. So she was like ashamed of it. And like, this is going to distract you from education and all these kind of things, right? So,
well, she wasn't wrong. I mean, you have ended up making games, so.
Games, that's true. She was a drug.
That's amazing. So yeah, your character in the game is from Tamil Nadu, which is the southernmost region of India. Is that where you grew up as well?
Yes, that's where I grew up. I grew up in the capital of Tamil Nadu, a city called Chennai.
Okay, yeah. I've been there.
Yeah, oh, really?
Yeah, and I went to Tirunelveli as well, which is around there, I think.
Yeah. Nice, nice. What did you get up to there?
Well, just quickly, it was when like I was a baby journalist reporter. I went out because of the tsunami, and I went out to about 18 months after that happened to report on, you know, sort of the cleanup operation, all of that.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
That's crazy. So we were in India at the same time.
Right.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah.
No way. Yeah. I didn't hear your mum's cries of anguish. Super Mario.
Yeah.
So yeah, what was the? How did you react to the news that you were moving to Canada and you're going to have to leave your Terminator behind?
Yeah, it was really scary. It was really scary. I was really attached to my friends. I had a great group of friends in school and everything.
Good.
And my only exposure to like Western, like I had no idea what the world would be like. Right? There was Home Alone. There was like movies, and then I read a Tom Sawyer book. And I read about how this teacher would beat Tom Sawyer in the hand or something like that. And I got like really scared. I remember that. But yeah, it was scary, but it was also very exciting. And we first came not to Toronto, but to Halifax, which is a much smaller city in Nova Scotia. And there was not much of an immigrant population. I was the only immigrant in my entire school.
What was the reason for your family moving?
They had a friend there.
Like
to go to Canada?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the reason for most immigrants moving here, right? Like they were wondering if Canada could provide better opportunities. And really, like my dad would keep saying, remember, we're only moving there for your education, which is, you know, no pressure for a 12-year-old.
Yeah, right. Wow. This is on you, tiny child.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why, like, you know, he was very disappointed that, I'm going into video games instead of something computer science or AI related.
Mm.
But, yeah, they thought it would be a better life. And in a lot of ways it is. I am really glad, you know, like, I'm really happy with the opportunities, and I think it's a huge privilege. But for my parents, it was a rough couple of years before my brother and I were able to find our footing and start to like take over and support them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a big, I mean, it's a huge change, obviously, but I guess it's just changing your entire trajectory for your life, isn't it? And you're no longer, your family is now halfway across the world and, you know, you don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a big deal. Do you still have friends from in India from when you were a tiny kid?
Yeah, definitely. I have family, I have cousins, and I have a couple friends that when I go back, I would like to see. But more excitingly, like stepping into game dev, there's like a fledgling, like really rapidly growing Indian game dev scene now, which didn't exist even if you go 5 or 6 years back. It was much smaller than what it is now. Like I've been talking to a lot of them who've been very excited about Venba and seeing the reception it's been getting. So, like, I have so many people that have promised me dinner when I go back to. So I'm really excited for
it. They want to show off their cooking skills to you, I guess. All right. Okay, Abby, let's come to your second game then. So, and tell us about this one from 1994.
Yeah, this one, I believe, is Sonic 3 and Knuckles. And I'm specifically picking Sonic 3 and Knuckles. Not Sonic 3 and not Sonic and Knuckles, but Sonic 3 and Knuckles. Which...
Wait, I don't know the difference. What is it?
I'll tell you. The difference is this pain can only be felt by a person who is a younger brother. Just like you get to be Luigi if you played Mario. If you play Sonic, you get to be Tails, not Sonic, right? But there's in Sonic 3, essentially, you can play as Sonic and Tails. You can play as Tails alone. My brother would play as Sonic, and I would play as my older brother. He would play as Sonic, and I would play as Tails. And he would, like... Tails is, like, invincible in that game. But basically, Sonic is the hero, right? Like, it would just follow Sonic the whole time. And I would play as Tails, and he would, like, make me hit the boss so that he doesn't get damaged and all these kind of things. But as a result, I got really attached to Tails as a character. So Sonic 3 is its own like set of six levels, and Sonic and Knuckles is its own set of six levels. But they're all part of like an overarching story. They can all be played as a singular game. But it's only when you play Sonic 3 and Knuckles together that you can play as Tails in both of them. So that's why it's important for me. And yeah, I think this game is fantastic, and I think I think maybe one of the best Sonic games of all time. And because I didn't have access to Mario as much, this was they got very creative with everything they can do in this game. The mechanics, he was just like brimming with like creativity, and the boss fights were really great. And it's the kind of game that you could keep playing over and over again. But what was really interesting to me even back then was like they did a really good job at storytelling. Like I think the way the game turns out is like Knuckles is like this annoying character who steals your emeralds and is sort of like the antagonist, but he's also tricked by Robotnik, and he has like a redemption arc where he joins your side at the end. And all of that was done like with no dialogue. It was done beautifully just with like animations and like that kind of cutscene and thing was very new for me.
Yes, right.
And keep in mind, I'm playing this in early 2000, and I'm saying this is new when people are playing, Final Fantasy VII and other games in the West. But I was like, God damn, this is really good. But yeah, I had my own, like I would tell my own stories like in my head with Sonic and these characters, even though I had access to none of the other materials, just this. For that reason, I think it was a really, really impactful game.
Yeah, I played the first Sonic and the second one with my brother when we were kids, but I don't think I ever played the third one, so might need to go back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was the older brother, so he would have had to be there. Sorry. I'm sorry. On behalf of older brothers everywhere.
No, it's good. It's good.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So yeah, so you turn up in Halifax, you said, so I think in Canada. How quickly did you feel like did it feel like home, I suppose?
Halifax, we were only there for a year before my parents decided to move to Toronto. But being the only immigrant kid there was a really interesting and fun experience.
And no other Indian kids at all?
No other immigrant kids at all in my school.
Right.
Like, to the point where, like, people would stop me in the streets, and then they would, like, take pictures with me.
What?
Like,
No yeah. way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was really, it was actually, they were the warmest and nicest people
right, sure.
ever. The first time I opened my lunchbox, you know, they were like, oh, what the hell is that? Like, they've never seen anything like it. But later on, they had like competitions where like every time I had lunch, they would have like spicy eating competitions because they would just find it too spicy. Like they had their own thing going on with it, which is really fun and interesting for me. And then they'd be like, look, he's just eating it and he's not even sweating. All of that was very fun and interesting for me. And then when I came to Toronto, it was very different, right? Like it was much more multicultural.
Mm, right.
Yeah, it was a completely different experience. Yeah.
Mm, mm. I mean, it's quite a big deal to move to Canada and then just start to get settled in a school and then after a year have to move again.
Yeah.
that must have been quite intense for you and yeah. your brother.
Yeah, 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 for sure. By end of the year, I was getting really happy about the school that I was going to and the friends and everything. So it did suck to have to move again, but it is, Halifax is like a coastal city. Software jobs weren't really high there. And my dad had to move to Toronto, but
right.
I think it was all for the best. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So he was working, who was he working for then? Just doing, you know, computer programming for you know, just PC software or stuff?
Yeah, yeah. So the thing is, he applied to come to Canada during Y2K times, right? That's when he applied. But the application, it took until 2006 for it to get approved.
Sure, wow.
And so, like, he was really trying to like, keep up in an industry that's cutting edge and really moving. And he had no formal training in software or any of those things. So all of that was self-taught, right?
Right.
Yeah, so I think it made things really difficult, but he would be in between jobs a lot, but he always made sure to provide
mm-hmm.
for the family.
Yeah.
So he would work like in banks as like, you know, a business analyst, you know, here and there. And it was always a question mark. It wasn't until my brother started going to work that things started to calm down. Like sometimes, like the confidence he has, like even with, like if you draw a comparison between him choosing to come to Canada with so little money and so little knowledge of what the life would be, with like what, how much, like how safe I played it before I quit my job to do Venba. Like he would have quit like way earlier than I did. I don't have like even 1% of the confidence either, so I'm really grateful for that.
And so are you secretly hoping to join the games industry at this point?
Yeah, so when I came to Halifax or Toronto, seeing like, you know, it was a whole new world, PS3 and Xbox after playing, you know, Dangerous Dave. So it was a big jump. And more than that, it's the way people talked about games here was very different. I saw adults speaking about games as if it was a serious and worthwhile thing, like as if it were movies, and they would talk about it as a career. So that really changed things versus in India, it was just like, okay, one more way the kids are ruining their lives, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
So that was that made it seem like, okay, this is a career I can pursue. And I started get into that. And because I was into computers and stuff like that, like programming to get into games seemed like a natural fit. And I think about in grade 12, I want to get into game design, like study game design or a game development program.
Mm-hmm.
But because that was a hard sell, what I decided to do instead was like a hard sell for my parents. I decided, okay, like what am I going to do in games? I'm probably going to be a programmer. So let me study programming mm-hmm. and then I'll get into games with that. So it kept my dad happy for 4 years because he was thinking, okay, he's going to work at Google or,
yeah.
you know, or whatever else.
But he can't
else.
Complain when that's his job as well, so.
yeah. Yeah. And looking back, I actually think, you know, I'm glad that my parents, like that pressure of my parents made me go into programming instead of those game design programs, because a lot of them are not quite useful, especially at the time. And like even now, I think the common wisdom is that like, if you want to get into game design, like, develop a skill instead of, like, going into a program for game design, right? Like,
uh-huh.
you know, do you want to be an artist or do you want to be a programmer or, like, you know, or, you know, producer? Like, go develop a separate skill that supplements it. Because I feel like at the time, especially the programs that I was looking at were, like, preying at the interests of, you know, these kids who wanted to pursue this for a living, right?
Uh-huh.
So in a way, that I'm also grateful for.
Yeah. Amazing. Right, Abby, let's come to your third game. Tell us about this one. Absolute classic.
Shadow of the Colossus? This game was the first, one of the first games I played on my PS2, which I got in grade 10 for $90 from a guy in a subway train that my dad finally, after like 2 years of asking and begging, is what I got.
Wait, what you mean on a subway train?
Oh, like it was a used PS2 sales that happened in a subway, and I was very excited for it. And And then my friends in high school who have moved on to like PS3s and Xboxes, Xbox 360s, they would be like giving me their PS2 games every once in a while to play. And my friend, he said, "Okay, check this game out. I'm not gonna tell you anything about it. You should go play Shadow of the Colossus."
Yeah.
And this game, like I remember, I played it like right before school started. Like I had an hour before the school started. I played it. I beat the first Colossi, and then I rushed to school, and I couldn't wait to come back home to play the rest of it, right? And it was just really amazing. I think even at the time, it was not like any other video game I'd played before it. The minimalism that's employed throughout the entire game, now I feel like a lot of the things that it introduced are now common, but like an empty world with just 16 boss fights.
Yeah, we should explain the game quickly. I think one guest has picked it before, but yeah, you play as this sort of like young boy trying to rescue his girlfriend, I guess, who seems to have passed away, and he's in this fantastical land, and he has to fight, like you say, these 16 stone giants or different kinds of giants, and there's no other enemies. You just sort of go through these huge canyons and approach them, and then you're climbing up the back of them, hoisting yourself up on the mossy surface of the Colossi, and it's very tragic when they fall down, isn't it? It's got a lot of melancholy.
Yeah, no, you did a fantastic job explaining that.
Thanks.
I think, yes, that's exactly it, right? Like, I think, you start by, you have this voice, you make a deal with, like, this voice that says, if you kill these 16 Colossi, they will bring your girlfriend or your partner or who knows, the game doesn't tell you,
sure,
back to life. So you do it. But what was really interesting for me is that the game will take you from fear, which is dread and anticipation, as you go searching for this Colossi. And then as you get to it, it'll take you through adrenaline and excitement and rage, and because you're trying to, take this Colossi down. And when you do take it down, it'll make you feel guilt and all of it within a span of, like, the thing that you dearly hunted and tried to take down, you're now feeling bad for, because really it was minding its own business before you came.
Yes.
You came there. I think it's just such a really good masterclass in telling the story through gameplay. And just making the players feel, like, the music and everything helps, but like really makes you feel like a piece of shit at the end of it. And it did that really well. And it did that effortlessly. Right? And there's, a story of corruption that's going underneath, and it's just very, very powerful. And I remember just the feeling of like hanging on to these giant bosses as they fling their heads, and you're just like hanging with like one hand. It's just such a strong visual memory that's etched into my brain. And like that kind of experience back then was so rare compared to how most games approached it, right? And I think the game also did very interesting things. Like, if you were riding your horse for a while, the game would pick up on that and, like, zoom out the camera in a way that it would use, like, the rule of thirds so that you're in one corner and then there's, like, a lot of empty space. It'll go for that kind of, like, landscape. So using the gameplay camera to cinematography was very interesting.
Yeah.
And, like, I can tell the world has so many details, like, with lizards and, like, these inscriptions and, like, these gardens. And I think there's, like, secrets that people are still finding to date about the game. It has so much lore, but it doesn't bother you with it. It's phenomenal. And Shadow of the Colossus introduced me to that Team Ico. And I picked up their other game, Ico, also, which is just, once again, another beautiful game.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, it even surprised me you saying it was for PlayStation 2. I mean, because they did the remaster more recently. But yeah, the idea that game was running on a PlayStation 2 is extraordinary, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Great. So let's come back to your story then, Abby. So you graduate and you work for IBM for a little while. What was that like?
IBM, I was a co-op and it was a giant company, a lot of bureaucracy. I made some great friends, lifelong friends from there. But it's like the thing that I kept telling myself was like, whatever this is, I want to do the opposite. opposite of this, right? So IBM was also... like, as a co-op, you don't really have much to do. So they'll give you a task, and, like, everything has to go up the chain of ranks before it comes back, right? So you make a web page, you send it to them, and it has to go up to, like, over 4 screening and approval processes. And then a month later, they're like, oh, change this one thing, right? So there wasn't much for me to do. I wasn't really learning a lot or anything. So I just ended up making video games in my spare time. While working at IBM, I was learning. That's when I started to learn Unity very seriously, which is the game engine that I use. Until then, like, I was trying to keep up with, like, computer science as a career thing, but IBM really ignited the fire that, okay, no, I have to get out. I have to do it.
Definitely want to make games. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you moved to this mobile game studio. Is it Yukon Games? Is that how you say it?
Yukon Games.
Yukon Games.
Yeah, Yukon Games. Okay. Yeah, Yukon Games. Yeah, so in my fourth year, I think there was a game-making competition, which, you know, I've put on a healthy amount of hours into it. We did pretty well in the competition, and because of that, I ended up getting a job at Yukon. And it was great. I think Yukon has had really great people. A lot of people there are pretty much my team right now are all people. Are like 90% of my team is people I met. I took them with me, yeah. So the artist Sam I met at Yukon, my two programmers, Sharon and Fafita, they're from Yukon. Yeah, I think for me, I fondly remember the conversations that Sam and I would have at lunch at Yukon, where we would talk, like, you know, what kind of games do we want to make? What do we want to... Like, there was that real passion that we both shared. And that's what eventually led to, you know, starting of the Benba, yeah.
I was looking up some of the games that they publish, and
yeah,
they do the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire game on Apple Arcade, which I actually think is brilliant. I play it quite regularly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's well designed, yeah.
Awesome. Okay, I'll let them know. They'll be to hear that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess it's popular because I'm on the Apple Arcade subscription, and it's like always in the top 10 games on that, I guess. But it's quite, because you sort of, it's a head-to-head game based on the TV series, but it's not actually live. I'm guessing it's sort of, you know, it fudges it. So you are playing real people, but they've already answered the questions earlier or something like that. Am I guessing correctly?
I can answer that.
Oh, you can't.
No,
I wasn't expecting you to break an NDA about Who Wants to Feel It. Well, anyway, did you work on that?
So I worked on Jeopardy, which is the game that I worked on. But Tatsuya, my programmer, he started out in Millionaire. Sam also, he did some artwork for Millionaire, yeah.
And so it's in your spare time that you're working on Jeopardy in the daytime, and then in the evening you're working on your projects of your own with your friend Sam.
Yes.
And Venba wasn't the first of these games, was it? What was the first one?
So The first one, and there was just an idea. It was scrapped pretty quickly. It was like a mythological, Indian mythological, like God of War, but duty kind of
okay.
like epic fighting game.
Okay, yeah.
That embarrasses me to even say.
Just starting small with a God of War alike.
Yeah, exactly. And this is I think, maybe when I was 23.
Yes.
But then after that, right when Apple Arcade was starting to take off, I had the idea. It's a game called Balloon Man. And the idea was that you play as this like depressed superhero in a world of superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And his only power is to like make balloons. but like, you know, at first he's depressed, you know, because his super means nothing in a world of like Iron Man's and Superman likes. Right?
So,
but eventually the story goes that you do have to take down these Iron Man, Superman likes, but with your balloon superpower. And how do you do that? It was sort of like a Mega Man kind of homage, and that's right. How it started. So we were working on that, and it was meant to be an Apple Arcade game.
It's a big leap, though, from that to, you know, making a sort of physics-based puzzler based on a superhero to making a narrative cooking game. You know, how did you make that logical leap so quickly?
It wasn't quite logical, but like as we were working on this, I just had the idea for when just at home, I was just, you know, observing my mom fuss over food. It was just getting to me how much food means to people like my mom, and how much me eating it or my brother eating it means, or how much us not eating it hurts. It's a complete expression of their affection. And if it doesn't reach through, like, they're devastated. And like, that's something I've always noticed about my mom. When that particular day, you know, I guess it hit me hard. And then immediately I was like, what if there was a game about,
yeah, how can I monetize this?
Yeah, exactly. How can I monetize this? No, I just had a scene that in my head, I just had the scene, which is the fifth level in Menba, where she cooks this giant dinner. And I just had that whole scene come to my head. And I just wanted to tell that story.
Yeah.
So immediately I just wrote it down as a couple texts.
Right.
And I sent it to Sam, who also happened to be with his mom at a restaurant when he got it. Manny was like, wow, this is really good. We should maybe make this instead. And then we were like, no, you know, because the classic meme for game devs is that you're working on a game and then you start another project, then you abandon your previous one. And for 2 weeks, like, Sam and I pretended that we were still going to make Balloon Man. And we just couldn't stop thinking about Venba. And at that time, it felt like a smaller scope game than
right.
Balloon Man.
We'll just quickly make Venba and then we'll go back to Balloon Man, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I remember Sam said, which we make fun of till this day, he said, like, this seems like a small game. I feel like we could do this in 4 months. and 3 years later.
Famous last words.
Famous last words, yes. Yeah.
Great. All right, let's come to your fourth game. What is it?
The fourth game is Halo 2. In general, I don't think Halo needs much introduction.
No.
I'm a huge fan of the Halo series in general, but this one I picked because I think it's one of my strongest gaming memories. And so I had two other friends when I was in high school who are all in similar situations to me, where like we all wanted to get gaming consoles and we wanted to play the latest and greatest games, but we couldn't. I would lug around my PS2 to my friend's place and we would all play it together, you know, stuff like that. But back then, the game we wanted to play the most was Halo 3. Like, we were really obsessed with it because we could play Halo 1 on our laptops in at like 10 frames per second, but we could still play it. But what happened was one day, often people would put out like their couches and like chairs and things like that. That would be very useful, like for garbage pickups. But they would also put it out there in case somebody else needs it. And my friend's mom would always be watching out for like Eagle Eye, right? Like she'd be like, okay, we're getting it. And he would call me because the dads would be out to work. So it would be us three who would be lifting those couches and everything and bringing it into the home. And one of these days, we saw like an abandoned computer, right? So immediately I was interested. And then it looked like a PC because it was open, the case was open, and I could see the parts inside. And then I realized it wasn't a PC, it was an Xbox, an abandoned Xbox. And immediately I was like, oh shit, this means we can play Halo 2, which was only on...
Crap that.
Only on Xbox at the time. So we brought it home, we found like a PC power plug and it booted up. And it was working, there was an Xbox Live account and everything set up. And then we sourced a copy of Halo 2 from one of my friends. But to make it work was a big iterative process. Eventually what happened was that I figured out that you had to put pressure on the CD drive to make it read the CD.
Right.
I remember this vividly. From my house, I brought like a big rice bag of basmati rice, and I placed it on top of the Xbox to make it read Halo 2. And that's literally how we played Halo 2 together. And to me, that memory is very strong because like how much we had to do, like it's a word co-op and everything, right? And it was such a communal experience with the three of us. Mm. So yeah, I'm forever grateful for that.
That's lovely, yeah. No wonder you ended up making a game about biryani. Could it all to basmati rice?
Yeah.
To fan.
Yeah. I owe a lot to basmati rice for sure. But it was also like, you know, it was also a fantastic game.
Yeah.
Great soundtrack and. Yeah, to me, it was, you know, for somebody who grew up on PC gaming and getting into console gaming, it was something that was flexing its muscles about, like, what could something like this be, right?
Right.
And I think we poured hours upon hours into the split-screen multiplayer and all of those things. Yeah,
yeah, amazing.
It was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was. It was a very anticipated game as well, wasn't it? People couldn't wait for Halo to come out, the second one.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's wind the clock forward a little bit. Here we are at the start of 2024. Your game came out last summer. It's done exceptionally well. I included it in my own roundup of, you know, some of the most significant games last year.
Oh, thank you.
How did Vember's success compare to your expectations? I mean, obviously, you'd worked on it for 3 years, but, you know, did you ever think it would attract so much attention?
No, definitely not this much attraction. I think we continue to be blown away by how much, how well it's doing or the level of reception it's getting. Like, I always thought that, you know, it's special and it might be something, but definitely not to this extent. And like, it doesn't seem to stop, right? Like, even recently with the IGF nominations, we expected we might get maybe one for two, but like to get the most nominations is not something we could have ever expected. And I think, you know, it's while we're working on it, I think it was definitely hard to getting it funded because it was a very different kind of game and it was also our first game. So, you know, we were inexperienced in pitching and how all of those things work. But I remember Sam would always be like, no, it'll all be fine. But once the game comes out, it's going to be great. And then now each time we do well, he's like, see, I told you so. But I'm like, no, you didn't. Like, you didn't know it'll do this well. So yeah, we're extremely grateful for that. And I think it's been a weird because when Venba came out, it didn't sink in. Like, I was sort of numb and all the reviews and everything, they just started to become like words after a point.
Sure.
But it's only now that it's starting to sink in. Like, when people say, you know, when people do these write-ups about like how much it means to them and things like that, it's starting to like really sink in. For me, the biggest, like all sorts of reactions, there's like this 8-year-old kid who made a video about Menba from Tamil Nadu, which I think is one of my favorite. Like he speaks about in Tamil and he's like, this is the pride of Tamil people.
Oh,
you know? Yeah, like all those things you can never expect. I think 2 days after launch, I got a photo from somebody. Like the amount of people who said it made them cry was definitely not something I expected. I got a photo from somebody who said like a close-up of their eyes to prove that they were crying while playing the game. So things like that, I think, has been pretty crazy.
I mean, that's so great. And, you know, I want to celebrate that, all that positivity with you. I am interested, though, you know, I suppose when you're representing immigrants' experience in this way, in any medium, you know, not just video games, but books or films, you know, there's, you know, that's quite a, it's quite a personal thing that you're doing there, isn't it? And did you have any comments from people who were less sort of enthusiastic about how their experiences had been communicated in the game? Or was generally everyone, you know, saying, yeah, this is it. This is what it's like.
Yeah. So this is definitely something that's a great, great point to bring up, because that's definitely something I was worried about while making Menba, to the point where it was starting to get suffocating for me, because I was like, okay, if I talk about this, then I'm not talking about that. But if I talk about this, then I'm...
Right.
Then mm-hmm. I had to like sort of let go of that idea and like really understand that the reason, like Menba is a representation, but it's not representative, right? Like it can't do all of it. It can only do one tiny bit. And eventually if there's a lot of tiny bits, then that could maybe be representative of something, right? So I sort of let go of that idea and I just steeled myself in my head, like, you know, some people are going to like it. Some people are going to hate it because it's not their experience. And that's okay. Particularly, I was worried about like accuracy and authenticity. Like I know that people from back home in India are often not happy with diaspora media. And they often feel like, you know, it's not accurate enough. They're misrepresenting facts. So when it's about food and recipes, you know, there's no place to hide. You have to really be accurate. But I think I can honestly say that, like, it's been pretty overwhelmingly warm and receptive, even from back home. Like, things that I was worried about, like, it almost feels like I was worried for nothing.
Well, I think you found the, you know, your answer there so spot on, I think. The idea that, you know, you tell a very specific story and in a way that becomes more universal. Whereas if, like you say, you're trying to, like, write defensively and try and please everyone, you end up with something that's sort of annoying to everyone. So I think you solve the problem, you know, in the creative phase, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, right? And I think it's so specific that somehow I feel like, you know, a lot of people ask, you know, is your main group of audience for this South Asians and who've immigrated or in similar position to the characters of the games? But that's not at all true, right? Like, I think everybody from all sorts of people with all sorts of experiences take away something from this, right? For example, in Japan, the response from Japan itself has been crazy. And it's not even translated in Japanese,
really?
Right? And they're just, like, Google translating. Like, they're taking pictures of every dialogue.
Oh, wow.
And, like, Google translating it. And they're cooking the recipes, you know, they are even, like, one person was even like, oh, I saw a Tamil movie way back then, and I think this dish is here. You know, they were making those kind of connections. Yeah. So, yeah, in general, I'm really happy. And I think even for game developers in India, they had the opposite idea, right? Like, they were wondering, do we have to make a GTA to, like, veto this by the... right? So, to see something like this get received well, I think shows them that, okay, we can make smaller games that can also do well. So
you don't have to make GTA. Yeah.
You don't have to make GTA. Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really, really happy about that. Yeah.
Brilliant. Right, Abby, let's come to your fifth and your final game then. Tell us about this one.
Yeah. So this game is called Papers, Please.
Thank you.
which is made by maybe one of my favorite game designers of all time, Lucas Pope, who's currently 2 for 2.
Yeah. At least 2 for 2, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So Papers, Please is this game about, you know, you being a border security agent and you check documents and people's passports, but your job is to, you know, do that. And if you do it properly, you know, you get paid and you have to balance, you can buy medicines and heating and everything for your family, but not really, because it's still kind of hard. But if you don't do it, sometimes you're in difficult positions where like you let the husband in and the husband says, you know, my wife is coming right after, and there's just the tiniest error. And you know that this person should be let in by all means, but you can deny them or you can let them in at the cost of, you know, doing a worse job and getting, you know, fined for it. So what I really, really like is there's this really heavy narrative that's going on in the game. And you engage with the narrative only through the core mechanics of checking the passport, right? It's all these tiny micro decisions you make. Yeah. Do you report this person or not? Do you let this person in or not, right? And there's so much it does with just that, that it's amazing. And you can completely disengage from it. And it can just be a game about passport checking for you, which some border agents do, right? Okay. So I think it's great. Yeah, I think it's one of the... for me, when people ask me, like, what are, like, Wenba's inspirations? Is it, like, Cooking Mama or something? My first answer and my biggest answer is always Papers, Please. And in a way, it's like I did try to approach the recipe cooking and design and the story around it in a very similar way.
Right.
And then somebody wrote an article about how Papers, Please and Wenba have a lot of things in common or something. And I'm like, wow, that's great. somebody actually picked up on it.
Right. Yeah, because I guess checking papers and bureaucracy is almost like following a recipe that's been given to you by the state, right?
It's a recipe.
And you're layering your story around that sort of quite utilitarian process.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's just all sorts of amazing. The sound design, the music. Is it just the way the intro credits, the title even comes?
Right.
It comes away slowly, like with the horn. I think it's fantastic. It's bleak. Yeah, definitely one of the best games of all time. Mm. Yeah, I think everybody should play it. And then he followed that up with Obra Dinn, which is also one of my favorite games of all time. Yeah.
Yes. Former guest of the show. So anyone who's interested, go back and listen to Lucas's episode. So, right. Brilliant. Abby, let's go through your consoles. So we've got here Dangerous Dave, Sonic 3 and Knuckles, Shadow of the Colossus, Halo 2 and Papers, Please. How are you feeling about that?
Can I tell you how I overthought so much about how to pick these 5 games?
Yeah, of course.
So at first I was like, okay, is it like a desert island kind of situation? Like, do I pick a console?
Some people take it that way, but not everyone.
Yeah, but I was like, you know what? I should just pick Dreams and Mario Maker, mm-hmm. right? Because it just gives you so much access. But it didn't feel quite right. And I think it's, for me, the spirit of the question is, what are some unique... And then, like, there's also, like, I wanted to go pretentious and pick, like, games that no one's heard of, you know?
Some people have done that as well. Sam Barlow.
But eventually, I was like, you know, I'm going to be honest. And, I want to recommend games that I played and I enjoyed it. And I think, yeah, so I'm pretty happy. I think it's very commercial, like, these 5 games that you list about.
Yeah.
But I'm happy about that, yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant stuff, right? We need a name for your console. You got any ideas for what we could call it, Abby?
Terminator 2.
Oh, Terminator 2. Yes.
Yeah.
So your mum could get mad all over again.
Yeah, bringing it right back. Yes. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm gonna let you go now because I think we've gone a bit long, but it's been absolutely wonderful to hear the story behind your life and Wenba as well. Thank you for sharing it with us. And we're all super excited to see whatever's next. I'm sure you're feeling the pressure, but take your time and we'll look forward to whenever it's ready.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to my guest, Appy. What an absolute treat that was. And what a lovely guy Appy is. I think we got a true sense of the kind of creative person he is, of his background, of the life that he's lived. And also, I think his empathy as well for older generations, for the journey of his parents and the parents of his friends, and what they gave up to pursue a better life for their family and for their children. And of course, that is the theme of his game, the game that he's worked on with his friend Sam and his other co-collaborators. It's Venba is the name of the game, V-E-N-B-A. You can read more about the game at venbagame.com. It's available pretty much everywhere you get your video games. So it's on Steam, it's on Nintendo Switch, Sony PlayStation, it's on Xbox Series and Xbox One. And probably it's on some of those like passes as well that you get for those. So I'm sure if you want to play Venba, you can. And if you're just interested in seeing a bit more, then Abby was talking there about how lots of people do let's plays of the game around the world. So you can certainly watch a video on YouTube or whatever to see what the game is about and follow the story if that's of interest to you, or if perhaps you don't own any consoles or anything like that. I know we do have a few listeners who are just interested in video games but don't necessarily play them. So yeah, check out YouTube, search up for some videos of Venba. Yeah, I loved Appy's choices. That is a great console. I'm a big fan of pretty much all of those games. Yeah, we heard about Shadow of the Colossus there. I mentioned that had been picked once before. That the guest that picked that game previously was Phil Wang, the comedian. Phil is in the news this week because he's just been revealed as the host of this year's video game BAFTA awards ceremony, which is happening next month in April. We might be doing an episode around that. It's not quite confirmed, but yeah, I'll let you know on that. But anyway, you should tune in and watch Phil doing his presentation. I know it's going to be great. Absolute perfect booking. Friend of the show, of course, go back and listen to Phil's episode from last year. Listen to him talk through his picks, which include, of course, Shadow of the Colossus, which Abby picked there. The one game actually in Abby's selection that I didn't know too much about was Dangerous Dave by John Romero. John Romero is very well known as the co-creator of Doom, which is just such an impactful game, and really, in some ways, I suppose, you could make the argument that it transformed the video game industry in the 1990s and paved the way for a lot of what came on to follow. I have been in contact with John. He would like to come on the podcast, so it's going to take, you know, he's a busy guy, and so it's going to take a little bit of figuring out, but maybe I'll get to get John on here. He certainly told me that he'd like to come on. So watch this space. That would be a real coup, wouldn't it, to hear John Romero's five picks. And I mentioned there at the end as well, Abby picked Papers, Please. We've also got an episode with the creator of that game, Lucas Pope. Lucas as well is in the news at the moment because he's got a new game out. It is called Mars After Midnight, and it's available for the Playdate. Now, if you don't know about the Playdate, it's this very cute little handheld, like a micro Game Boy, and it's big in, it's got a black and white LCD screen like the old handhelds of the 1980s and 1990s, and its big thing is it's got a crank. So as well as having buttons on the side of the little device, it's got a tiny little metallic crank that you turn around, and lots of brilliant designers have come up with clever ways to use that crank. So yeah, if you are interested in that, search up for the Playdate, and of course look up Lucas's new game for that, Mars After Midnight. I've not played it myself, but I've been hearing very, very good things, as you would expect from someone who is, I think, one of the medium's foremost designers working today. How great as well was it to hear about the bag of basmati rice that Abby and his friends used to hold down the disk drive on the Xbox that they found in the street. I mean, cool, what an anecdote. And the fact that, of course, then the game that has made Abby known in this medium involves basmati rice. That was very pleasing to me.
Oh, just so good. So good. Right. Wasn't it lovely to hear from Abby? Anyway, yeah, give him a follow. He's on social media and all of that. And certainly follow the work that that studio is doing. They are exciting young things. And I think they're going to continue to do very good stuff. Right. If you're enjoying the podcast, please become a Patreon supporter. Head to patreon.com/myperfectconsole. Become a supporter for the cost of a magazine a month. It helps support the podcast, make it sustainable. If you just enjoy it, it's a great way just to, you know, pledge your support and help me to keep making it. But of course, you do get some benefits. You get your episodes early and ad free. You get bonus episodes once a month. Now we're doing a new feature called My Perfect Game of the Month, where we pick a guest, one game picked by one of the guests, and then for the next month we play through it. Currently, we're playing through Yoshinori Kitase's Choice Factorio, which you can play on Switch and you can play on Steam. You play as an engineer in the game, and you're sort of crash landed onto a alien planet, and you have to scavenge resources and sort of build up a little factory to help you eventually leave the planet. That's the premise of the game. It's really, really compelling. It's quite PC-y and takes a little bit of getting into. But once it all clicks, it's wonderful, wonderfully compelling. So yeah, if you're interested in that, download Factorio. There's a demo of the game. You can play that. And then you can also tune in, if you're a Patreon supporter, to myself and the comedian Glenn Moore chatting about the game. That'll be coming out in a week or so. Next week's guest, we've got an interesting guest. So, let's see how this goes. But up until now, every guest of My Perfect Console has been someone who loves video games, who's passionate about them, who maybe works creating video games, or who, if they work in another industry, then who just has enjoyed video games and perhaps they've influenced their other work in some way. Next week's guest is Jack Thompson, I'm going to say disgraced lawyer. He is a former lawyer who was disbarred by the state of Florida. He gained notoriety, I will say, in the late 90s and early 2000s as a vociferous anti-video game campaigner. That's how most people would know him. He would argue the point, I think, that he's not an anti-video game campaigner. He's an anti-selling 18-rated games to underage children campaigner. But anyway, certainly in the early 2000s, he became sort of the person who people who play video games love to hate. He was sort of the pantomime villain, and he was wheeled out onto the news programs after any time there was a school shooting in America and would talk about how video game companies were in some way culpable. Yeah, so he has disappeared really from the public eye, I would say, for the past two decades since he was disbarred. He's now in his mid-70s. He had a major sort of health scare quite recently. And, you know, I just thought, why not have a chat with Jack Thompson, see what makes him tick, see how he reflects on that period of his life a couple of decades ago, what it was like to be a pariah, what the actual nuances of his beliefs maybe are or aren't. And so, yeah, we have that conversation. I was quite nervous before I spoke to him, but then we spoke and it was all right. And I think it's worthwhile and meaningful. Obviously, you know, it's going to be one of those episodes that I think people will be interested in because he's someone that we don't hear from very often. But I think, you know, aside from the shock value of having him on My Perfect Console, I think it is a meaningful chat as well. And you can see how we figured out which games we were going to talk about by downloading that episode. And, you know, I think I had more of a perhaps journalistic hat on for this interview, so I do press him on quite a few of the things that he says and believes, and we have a meaningful dialogue. So just a heads up, you're going to see that flash into your podcast app if you're a subscriber next week, and I just wanted to preface what you can expect in that conversation, because I've already had a little bit of feedback from some of the Patreon supporters who are like, why have you got him on, you know, I'm not going to skip that one or whatever. So, you know, if you want to skip it, understand. If not, do so with an open mind, you know, sort of imagine it a bit more like a, you know, Louis Theroux interview or something like that, where it's someone who has maybe beliefs different to you, who's being allowed to express those
in a way where they're being challenged on them to explain them and defend them in some ways. Anyway, enough of all that. It's going to be an interesting one, I will say. All right. So, yes, and then in April, we'll be back with some people who really love video games. So don't worry about that. Okay, I'll be back again next week with Jack Thompson with his five games, or, you know, brackets, the five games I've picked for him, and one more perfect console. Until then, have a great week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.